This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Can Alzheimer's disease be reversed? Just asking that question likely evokes strong opinions and emotions. But one neuroscientist says it may be possible if science is willing to get uncomfortable.
This is more complicated, and we're using that old tired checkers strategy for the chess match of Alzheimer's disease.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about the new book, The End of Alzheimer's. We'll also talk to the winner of a fellowship from the NIH about his research into HIV and other chronic diseases. And we'll spend an academic minute searching for happiness in a depressing world. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Dale Bredesen is an internationally renowned expert in neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's disease. In 2014, Dr. Bredesen published his innovative approach to Alzheimer's treatment in the scientific journal Aging. Since then, he has trained hundreds of physicians and healthcare professionals in his RECODE protocol, reversing cognitive decline in upwards of 200 individuals. On October 22nd, he released his book, The End of Alzheimer's, the first program to prevent and reverse cognitive decline, which goes into immense detail regarding this protocol. Dr. Bredesen discussed his approach and book with The Best of Our Knowledge's Elizabeth Hill.
Dr. Bredesen.
Yeah, hi, Liz. How are you doing?
I was able to catch up with Dr. Bredesen via phone from the West Coast. Immediately, I admitted to my skepticism when I first picked up his book. However, by the end of part one, it all made sense. We began by going into detail about Alzheimer's disease itself. He stated it's a chronic, progressive, neurodegenerative disease that results in cognitive decline. This causes trouble with memory, organizing things, and ultimately creates an inability to take care of yourself. He went on to state that Alzheimer's has become extremely common and is the third leading cause of death in the United States. I asked Dr. Bredesen to differentiate between his perspective and approach to Alzheimer's and the perspective and approach that has been historically accepted within the medical community.
If you look very simply at the fact that we are extremely complex organisms, and yet we are looking at complex chronic diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and cancer and cardiovascular disease as things that we would like to use a monotherapy for. So these are complex chronic illnesses. You need a much, much larger data set so that you can look to see what is actually causing the problem.
With over three decades of research, Dr. Bredesen has come to the scientific and medical conclusion that the amyloid plaque that indicates Alzheimer's disease develops as a protective response to three different classes of insults. The first of these three types is a constant inflammation that can be caused by pathogens such as Lyme disease or herpes simplex.
A-beta, the amyloid, is quite a good endogenous antimicrobial. So your brain makes this to kill these microbes. And yes, it also has a downsizing effect on your synapses. Secondly, if you withdraw trophic support, and by that I mean nerve growth factor, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, estradiol, testosterone, progesterone, pregnenolone, thyroid, on and on and on, if you decrease that, you go into the red, literally.
Dr. Bredesen likened going into the red to a company. When a company goes into the red, there's a hiring freeze and no new employees are hired. When a patient's diagnosed with Alzheimer's, no new memories can be formed. The third and final insult are neurotoxins. These neurotoxins can be caused by mold, metal, or other microbes. He talked about all of the stuff that was floating in the air on 9/11, and now studies have been published that 12.9% of first responders, now in their early 50s, are already experiencing cognitive decline. To help tackle these types of Alzheimer's, Dr. Bredesen created the RECODE protocol. This protocol is unique to every patient. He talked about oncologists who had the ability to sequence your genome, your tumor's genome, compare the two, and figure out what is driving your cancer. But that's not an option for Alzheimer's.
We don't have a tumor to biopsy in Alzheimer's, of course, or in cognitive decline. So we look at currently 150 different metabolic, toxic, and historical and imaging pieces to look at what is actually driving your cognitive decline. And as I said earlier, 10 to 25 is a typical number that we find that are abnormal. And then we address each of those.
I wanted to hear about the results of being on the RECODE protocol. So I had Dr. Bredesen read an excerpt from his book.
Edward was a brilliant professional who had businesses on both the East and West Coasts. He would meet with his accountants and add columns of numbers immediately in his head before the accountants could do so on their calculators. As he approached 60, however, he began to have memory problems. One day at the gym, he panicked when he forgot the combination to his locker, and his lock had to be cut. His memory continued to decline. He could no longer add columns of numbers rapidly in his head, and he had difficulty remembering people he had met. A PET scan revealed a pattern typical of Alzheimer's disease. Edward had extensive quantitative neuropsychological evaluations, which supported the PET results. He learned he was APOE4 positive, providing further evidence that his developing dementia was due to Alzheimer's disease. He continued to decline, according to neuropsychological evaluations, at a rate that accelerated when he was 67. And 2 years later, his neuropsychological evaluation revealed such marked memory loss and cognitive dysfunction that the neuropsychologist suggested he wind down his business and plan for the full-time care he would soon need. His wife brought him to meet with me, and he began on the RECODE protocol in December 2013. Now, I'm going to skip forward to after 22 months on the protocol, he went back and had his neuropsychological profile done once again. My wife and I were driving up the California coast from Los Angeles to San Francisco when my cell phone rang. It was the neuropsychologist asking me to come in to go over the testing results for Edward. In his 30 years of practice, he said, he had never seen such results. Edward's California Verbal Learning Test, CVLT, which assesses verbal memory abilities and is a test that is often markedly abnormal in Alzheimer's patients, had improved from the third percentile to the 84th percentile. His auditory delayed memory had improved from the 13th percentile to the 79th percentile. And then at the end here, Edward said to me, I have allowed myself to think about the future once again when I talk to my grandchildren.
Bredesen has appeared to have cracked the enigma known as Alzheimer's.
So the responses have ranged from ignoring it to comparing it to a diet, which is silly because this is actually targeted molecular biology. So we've spent 28 years in the lab looking at what are the drivers. I worked with two Nobel laureates when I was training. So we're looking at what actually drives the process. The surprise is it didn't turn out to be what everybody thought it was going to be. This was supposed to be another illness where we keep searching and then we find a drug which actually helps you. And the problem is that this is a much more complex chronic problem than had been realized. So this is not, you know, this is not the 20th century approach where you're going to kill the pneumococcal bacterium and get better from your pneumococcal pneumonia. This is more complicated, and we're using that old tired checkers strategy for the chess match of Alzheimer's disease.
In the heated debate over U.S. healthcare policies, Alzheimer's is known to cause heavy burdens on the Medicare and Medicaid systems. In a world where gene editing at the embryonic level can scrub mutations and correct genetic disorders before we're even born, he shied away from my eugenics fear and left me with one final thought. Drug testing should be done on the backbone of a program. We're simply asking these drugs to do far more than they're capable of doing. Dr. Dale Bredesen is the author of The End of Alzheimer's, the first program to prevent and reverse cognitive decline. For the best of our knowledge, I'm Elizabeth Hill.
Still to come, another researcher has been recognized for his work on HIV and other chronic diseases. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Some of the most important scientific research being done today is happening in small universities. And to support that work, the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, a division of the National Institute of Health, sponsors the PRIDE Fellowship. PRIDE loosely stands for Programs to Increase Diversity Among Individuals Engaged in Health-Related Research. One of this year's fellowship winners is Dr. Peter Mamaya, Assistant Professor of Epidemiology and Public Health in the University of West Florida's College of Health. Dr. Mamaya has been recognized for his work studying HIV and other chronic diseases. We spoke about the fellowship and his research.
Right now we are looking at HIV and chronic diseases. So we are doing this study in Tanzania, where we're looking at biomarkers of diabetes and cardiovascular disease among HIV patients. So HIV patients have been on treatment for this long, but we don't know, are they experiencing cardiovascular diseases and diabetes higher than the general population? So we are doing this study in Tanzania. We would have preferred to do it in the U.S. However, the amount of time it takes to do it in the U.S. is much longer. What we've seen also is that studies being done internationally are now being brought back to the U.S. We've seen that for HIV, where they call pre-exposure prophylaxis, where if someone gets exposed to the HIV virus, they can get medications. And those were basically studies that were done in Africa, and then the findings were translated in the U.S. and actually affected the guidelines in the U.S. So we are hoping this study that we are doing will probably be the same, where we can be able to understand whether HIV patients are experiencing a higher rate of cardiovascular disease and diabetes. So that's one study that I was doing. The second study that we also do is we do capacity building for healthcare providers. So capacity building in terms of them being able to understand the data that they collect. So they collect all this data, and we know that they need that data for evidence-based decision-making. But most of them don't look at it. It takes people from outside, I would say outside researchers who come in and take their data and we publish. But the people on the ground really don't do that. So we came up with a very simple training curriculum, and now we are training healthcare providers. Actually, we start with the healthcare managers in different countries. So we are doing it in Kenya, Tanzania, and Rwanda. Then the third thing we're doing is we're looking to work with our company called Medic Mobile. Medic Mobile does mobile health platforms for antenatal and postnatal women, so for pregnant women, making sure that they are being followed up in the community. Because what we see is that most women show up at the clinic when they are pregnant, but then they don't follow through. And what happens is that they get complications during pregnancy. We have high maternal mortality. We have high infant mortality. So we are partnering with this Medic Mobile to apply for some funding to see whether we can be able to increase attendance for pregnant women.
Is this HIV positive pregnant women?
Not necessarily. So it's just the general population.
So you've gotten a fellowship to continue. Is it all of these studies or just one?
So the study that caught the attention was the first study, which is the HIV and chronic diseases, because PRIDE itself is sponsored by the National Heart and Lung Blood Institute at the NIH. And so they're really interested in finding out the intersection between HIV and other chronic diseases. So that's what caught their attention.
I still, just a quick aside, as someone who's old enough to remember the beginning of the HIV epidemic, calling it now a chronic disease is just amazing.
Yes. It's come a long way. It's come a long way. So people are living. We are seeing life expectancy rates are almost similar to the general population, which is a good thing, which is a good thing.
And that's in the U.S. That's a different situation in the countries that you're working with.
Yes, yes. Although now the good thing is that there's been an influx of drugs thanks to a lot of U.S. funding that's gone to Africa, sub-Saharan Africa especially, and we are seeing patients living longer. They are getting better medications, and they're still living just as long.
What is the end point of your research? What do you hope to accomplish with this knowledge?
So for the HIV and chronic disease, what we hope to accomplish is, our hypothesis is that people who are on HIV treatment have a higher rate of cardiovascular disease and diabetes, and we are hoping that that information can be integrated into the guidelines so that when a HIV patient comes to the clinic, they can also be screened for diabetes and cardiovascular disease, not just HIV as a disease.
Do you also see that some of your research has to do with HIV positive patients and sleep?
Yes. So within this HIV and chronic diseases, we have a survey. Within the survey, we're also trying to find out whether people are sleeping less. Are they getting enough sleep? Are they stressed? These are factors which are a little bit difficult to measure, especially in the populations in Africa, because I guess their value system is a little bit different. So people won't report a lot of stress like we get it in the US. People won't say that they're having a bad day because everyone has that positive affirmation and everyone is living well. But we have a survey and we hope that it will be able to tell us a little bit about sleep patterns among HIV patients.
Yeah, it was something I quickly searched for that in HIV and sleep, and wow, there's a lot of information about that.
Yes, especially in the U.S., they're doing a lot of good studies. One of the faculty members we had at Pride is also looking at sleeping patterns among HIV patients. So very well published, very good information is coming out.
All right. Well, if someone to make out a business card for you, the word epidemiologist would be on there. Talk about some of the field work that you've done as an epidemiologist.
Okay, my fieldwork ranges from different things. I'm just as an overview, I'm interested in the social determinants of health. So what are these other things? What are these other social things, psychological things, structural barriers that really affect our health? We're even seeing studies now that are showing that where you live really affects your health, which is quite interesting. So I have done a lot of work, mostly with HIV patients, working with healthcare providers. We've been able to set up health systems, coming in and helping them come up with checklists, come up with guidelines. I'm working with the national governments in a couple of countries and helping them write up guidelines. I recently helped write a guideline called the Elimination of Mother-to-Child Transmission. The world, through the WHO, through the World Health Organization, is trying to move towards zero elimination so that the mother does not transmit the virus to the child. And so we thought it's important for us to have a guideline that makes sure that we follow up the women, we make sure that they are tested and they are not able to transmit the virus. The drugs we have right now are potent, I would say, in a good way, where that if the person strictly adheres to their regimen, they will not be able to transmit their virus, whether they have intercourse with or without a condom. They'll not be able to transmit the virus. So we make sure that the mothers are able to strictly adhere to the regimen, and that way they're not able to transmit the virus to the child.
And those drugs, as potent as they are, do not harm the child?
They do not harm the child.
That's amazing.
That's what we are seeing right now. They do not harm the child. The good thing is that now we have generations. You know, we have a lot of children that were born in the 80s and the 90s, and they're doing pretty well right now.
Well, your fellowship has started. Where have you been and where are you going?
Okay. So the fellowship started, it started July 30th, I think. We were there for 2 weeks. It was more of an orientation, so different scholars from different schools. We have all these faculty that come in from different parts of the country, I would say of the world, who are experts mostly in addressing health disparities. This Pride Fellowship is really geared towards, I would say, minority scholars. What we're seeing is few faculty, basically, I would say about 3% of the faculty in universities are comprised of African Americans or black folk, I would say. And also what we're seeing, even from studies that have come out of NIH, is that a lot of people who write proposals, they don't get their proposals funded. And it's because basically I don't think they address some of the needs. And so there's a concerted effort by NIH and other partners and other schools, and including the New York University, to make sure that this is addressed. So how can we make sure that minority scholars are trained in how to advance their research, in how to write good proposals, in how to network with the right people? At times, having the right person on your team gives you more credibility, and just making sure that whatever it is that we're doing also reflects into our teaching.
Where do you go with the fellowship?
So the fellowship is going to be 1 year. By the end of it all, we hope to be better researchers. We hope to be able to submit a couple of grants out of this. We also hope to continue with some of the collaborations. Again, I've met outstanding faculty, people who are very well experienced in their fields. Some of the things that we're actually even thinking of is bringing some of them to UWF and having a talk here and meeting other faculty and probably advancing some of the work that we've heard about them.
Do you know about how many people have applied for this fellowship?
It was very competitive. And so they talked about having about 50 applicants, and they picked 12. The 50 applications are the ones that just met the criteria, so they had more than that. What I saw was also, you know, a lot of people from, Ivy League schools, a lot of minority scholars from Ivy League schools. A lot of other schools get forgotten, so I think this was a good thing. It was a good exposure also for University of West Florida as well. I also think it's also beneficial for some of my students because I'm able to now partner them with other folks that are doing stuff in other areas. So if one of my students is, for example, interested in understanding fatigue, and now I know someone who's interested in fatigue studies, and that way I can be able to link some of my students to such such scholars. So I think it's a good thing.
Do you have ideas for the next fellowship after this?
For myself?
Yes.
Okay, yes, so I am looking, there's also an NIH minority fellowship that's coming up next summer. I'm hoping to apply for that. It's also quite prestigious and really difficult to get in, but I'm hoping with some of the growing I'll have done through the Pride Fellowship, I'll be able to get into that. But my overall strategy is just to be able to really focus a lot in incorporate some of my research into my teaching, and see how best I can be able to involve my students and bring other colleagues towards some of the stuff that you're doing.
Dr. Peter Mamaya is an assistant professor of epidemiology and public health at the University of West Florida's College of Health in Pensacola. Here in the U.S., we pride ourselves on life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Problem with that last part is pursuing happiness is causing a lot of depression. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Our search for happiness might be leading to depression. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Brock Bastian, associate professor in the School of Psychological Sciences at the University of Melbourne, explores whether seeking something could be pushing it farther away.
Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. It is reaching epidemic proportions, especially within the West. This raises the question of what it is about Western culture that may be causing depression. Recently, we asked people who were feeling depressed to complete a short survey each day for a month, asking them about their depressive symptoms as well as whether they had felt socially pressured not to experience feelings of anxiety or depression on that day. Also, whether they thought that others saw them as a failure when they did have those feelings. We found that this social pressure reliably predicted increased symptoms of depression on the next day, even when controlling for depression on the previous day. Furthermore, using network analysis, we were able to show that this social pressure was central within a network of depressive symptoms. In another study, we recreated the type of social environment that might lead to this social pressure by decking out a room with happiness books and posters, and then induced people to experience failure on a task, either in the happy room or a normal room. Participants in the happy room were 3 times more likely to ruminate on their failure compared to those in the normal room. We know that rumination is closely linked to depression, and by reconstructing a kind of micro-happiness culture in one of our testing rooms, we had shown that people respond badly to negative setbacks in environments where happiness is highly valued. Promoting happiness has many benefits, but when people feel pressured to be happy all the time and that they should never experience negative emotions, this appears to ironically promote, rather than alleviate, the experience of depression. We strongly believe that the causes of depression need to be understood in a way that reaches beyond individuals to the societies and cultures in which they live.
That was Brock Bastian of the University of Melbourne. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.